Blog Talk Radio.
From the table up at Birdland to the place where Dizzy dwells, in the beards and the funny hats they love so well. All the boppers are assembled, and when they're really high, they constitute a weird personnel. All the riffs these cats are playing are crazy, cool, and gone like this. Ooly-oo, Scooby-Goo, Ooby-Dooby-Dooby, Ooba-Bee-Doppin' like that. So let them beat their brains out till their flatted fifths are gone, and they'll pass and be forgotten like the rest. Yes, they're poor little cats who have lost their way. Ba 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 ba. But every wrong note that they play is a gem. So Lord have mercy on every one of them, for they Bye-bye.
Welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. We are going to cover tonight a book I just got, a New York Times bestseller. It's about General Stanley McChrystal, and his book is entitled My Share of the Task. You can see this guy's a team player just from the name on the cover. In the meantime, I'm going to play you a tune while I gear up. And the tune is dedicated to a Marine sergeant who was denied three times the Medal of Honor. And he's a Latino, and he threw himself on a grenade, and they're denying him the Medal of Honor. I'm surprised they didn't put his body parts in Fort Leavenworth like they're doing to all the other guys they're busting out. Yeah, and that's why I've got McChrystal's book, because I want to see how he got busted out. Okay, so hang in there, my friends, and we'll give you a dedication to all the Latinos who serve this country, the Americanos.
Ojitos bonitos. ¡Ay! Qué bonitos ojos tienes, debajo razón. Yo te concedo razón si por pobre me desprecias.
Yo no te ofrezco riqueza, te ofrezco mi corazón. Te ofrezco mi corazón a cambio de mis pobres.
Salerosa. Okay, we're looking at the book entitled My Share of the Task. Stanley McChrystal retired in July 2010 as a four-star general in the U.S. Army. His last assignment was as the commander of the International Security Assistance Force and as commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He was commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He had previously served as the director of the Joint Staff and as the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. He is currently a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs and the co-founder of the McChrystal Group, a leadership consulting firm. He and his wife of 36 years, Annie, live in Virginia. My Share of the Task, a memoir. And then he has a quote, "With weeping and with laughter, still is the story told, how well Horatius kept at the bridge in the brave days of old." And then he's got a little footnote, "Dedicated to those who kept the bridge and to those who made it possible." He's a team player. So I'm going to give you his preface, and that's what I'm going to read to you. "All wars are different, and every soldier's experience is unique, or so we each believe. But when I left the Army in the summer of 2010, more than 38 years after I entered West Point, it was clear I'd been part of something special. The roles and the experiences I have had were different than those I expected. And the people I met, those I served with, and even those I fought bitterly against, shaped what I did and who I was in surprising, even curious ways. Earlier in my life, I thought at some point I might write about leadership because it has always fascinated me, but had never considered writing about my own. And for that reason, and for many others, I kept no journal, notes, or files." Can you see some of these other generals? Look, you know, they've got publicists walking alongside them all day and night. My wife Annie produced boxes of my letters, and she kept from separations early in my career. But when I decided to write my own story, I began with little beyond what was in my head and in my heart, and what I had learned during my service, and what I felt about it all, wasn't immediately clear to me. I was proud of what we'd done and knew that the experience of my career, particularly the final decade in Iraq and Afghanistan, had transformed me. But it was only after the laborious 2.5-year process of researching, writing, editing, and re-editing months of media interviews and book talks, and ultimately reading and hearing the judgments of readers, reviewers, and comrades, that it has all begun to come into some real focus. And I suspect the process will continue. To some, my share of the task will be a war story. After the first section in which I recount my formative early career, I seek to provide a detailed, often gritty account of the fight against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and of our effort to recover a faltering effort in Afghanistan. You are taken into the shadows of wars marked by their brutality and vexing complexity and introduced to actual protagonists too often viewed as one-dimensional stereotypes, yet they are real and all too human. At its heart, however, is the story of change. It tells how America's most elite Special Operations Command, carefully constructed from the ashes of failure in the Iranian desert in 1980 into a force of stunning competence, had to transform itself in the midst of combat to avoid defeat. And it shows how I, after being molded by 25 years of military leadership, came face to face with a terrorist network whose ruthless leader leveraged tactics, technology, religion, and emotion to effectively change the rules of the game. Zarqawi's challenge demanded that I change how I thought and how I led. Zarqawi, and who was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Change is disruptive and frightening. People and organizations develop habits and cultures based upon what has worked in the past. They cope with the environment around them and deal with challenges that over time can become familiar. They grow confident in proven solutions. What worked before becomes the default response. Seniority and experience start to become synonymous with wisdom. Process guarantees predictable competence, and it is comfortable. As organizations grow, this phenomenon is magnified. There seems to be safety in size, wealth, and or technological superiority. Mass compensates for the loss of speed and agility. People judge little problems less as problems and more as small distractions. Big is reassuring. Even potentially mortal threats seem less daunting. Rome fell, to be sure, but it took quite a long time. Such thoughts are comforting to all but those around when things finally come crashing down. I found that this was exactly what had happened to the Special Operations Command when I took charge of it in 2003. We were great at what we did, indeed unequaled. But we weren't right for what needed to be done. We were losing to a side that lacked our resources and professionalism. But no one outside the force would dare tell us to change. It had to come from within. Most of us knew the real magic resided in small teams, the basketball team, the assault team, or even a small group of roommates creating a startup. From our own experience, we knew that in small teams, communication flowed effortlessly, and we seemed to think and act as one. When part of such a team, we could analyze a situation, decide and act as though it was a single, uninterrupted motion, like catching and throwing a baseball. Even a complicated double play required no meetings, emails, or orders. We instinctively knew what to do, or at least that's how it felt. The challenge then was to retain our inherent strengths of competence and precision, yet regain the innovation, adaptability, and focus of a small team. Unexpectedly, I found that the very tools that held the potential for our success were initially limiting our effectiveness by hampering the ability of small teams to act. Our ability to instantaneously communicate, to command and control our forces, and to collect an inexhaustible volume of intelligence was being applied to legacy processes that pulled information to the top and tended to centralize and slow decision-making. The counterintuitive solution came slowly, and the tuition for our education was paid in blood. We had to simultaneously leverage our ability to create a peerless network across which critical information could flow while using that shared consciousness of the environment and our enemy to unlock the magic that lay in the many teams across the command. We inverted a structure and processes designed to inform the commander who would then direct teams what to do and reshape them to instead inform the teams and thus empower them to decide without top-down decision and direction. In time, I found that these teams are no longer needed to be told what to do. They already knew. The change was more cultural than structural. Leaders at every level had to redefine their roles, and that started with me. I had to forego the model of leadership I'd grown up learning to emulate. Wellington at Waterloo, issuing timely orders on small sheets of paper, kept handily rolled into the buttonholes of his waistcoat, and became a facilitator who kept the flow of information going, the cultural innovative, and the organization focused on the mission. It was a change I found I could accept. Losing was something I wouldn't. For a few, this story will be a disappointment. Readers who seek a titillating insights on stories that briefly captured headlines or are hungry for character assassinations of newsworthy personalities must look elsewhere. Their exclusion was intentional. Instead, I concentrated on the issues and actions that actually dominated my thoughts and energy. As we gain this perspective that time offers, the truly significant questions and considerations will become clear. I've tried to highlight those I feel rise to that level. Finally, this is also a love story. I never set out to write one, and I only realized what I'd done when the book was complete. But by then it was clear to me for over 38 years in uniform, I loved being a soldier. I felt deeply about the people I served alongside, those I sweated and laughed with, whose weddings I'd attended and whose funerals Annie and I would painfully endure. I loved the humor, the occasional fear, the shared frustrations, and while detesting the bloodshed, I loved the sense of mission we had borne in Iraq and Afghanistan. When I left the service suddenly in 2010, uncertain from the sudden experience of controversy, Annie kept us firmly focused on the future. Memories, she believes, are to be valued and enjoyed, but life lies to our front. Annie lives as she drives, with little use for the with the rearview mirror. So, in the late summer of 2010, I started a business with a friend, colleague from Iraq and Afghanistan, a former SEAL, Dave Silverman. Our lofty goal was to make America better by helping companies navigate the same unsettling challenges we faced in the military, operating entirely separate from the government or defense sectors that would have been familiar to us. We believe the challenges of leadership and changes we faced have universal relevance. And we have found that to be correct. We have learned that even out of uniform we make a difference. When what began modestly and operated from Annie's kitchen table for the first 9 months, McChrystal Group has grown to over 50 people and has become the new team and new mission central to my life. But not the most important love of my life. And through it all, from the day we met at the very beginning, I loved Annie for a young wife who wakened me suddenly by loudly crushing huge cockroaches with her then fashionable wooden clogs on the 50-year-old hardwood floors of our army quarters we were sleeping on until our furniture arrived. Annie had grown into a thoughtful woman of extraordinary strength, like the sturdy foundation upon which a house rests. Annie anchored me and gave meaning to it all, and still she does. Could you see Bill Clinton writing this? Yeah. Okay, so that's Stan McChrystal, and he wrote it on August of 2013. So I thought I'd give you that little preface. So now you know a little bit more about McChrystal. And I know nothing about McChrystal, very little. All I know is that he was shafted for being an American, and he was double-crossed. And his 38 years of military experience was washed out by a community activist who plays race cards and entertains a communist takeovers. So having said that, I will now calm down, and I'm going to give you another Latin tune. This is 5 minutes. I'll cut it short. Take those trumpets. Okay, we're back to General McChrystal. What I first read you was the preface to his book. And now we're going to read the author's foreword. And then it's a two-pager. In late 1963, when I was 9, I almost burned our house down. I had draped my red Mario's Pizza basketball team uniform over a lamp in the room my brother David and I shared because I liked the red glow it produced, and then went off somewhere. Sometime later, my father detected smoke, raced to my room, and found my melted nylon uniform and the growing fire on the wooden desk he built for us. I was upset and even more embarrassed. So a day or so later, he sat me down to talk about it. He had just come home from work at the Pentagon, and I remember his green Army Major's uniform, seemingly covered with ribbons, as he sat in my room and talked about how hard it was to take responsibility for mistakes. He used President Kennedy's leadership and courage after the Bay of Pigs fiasco as an example. It had only been a few weeks since Kennedy had been assassinated, so it was a powerful weave of history, leadership, and life, even for a 9-year-old. If I have accomplished my intent, this book weaves two threads that have always fascinated me, history and leadership, around a third, my memoirs, the story of my life. The framework is history, the forces, events, and personalities that shaped the extraordinary era in which I've lived. Because things have moved so quickly and changed so radically, it could almost be described as multiple eras. The Army I knew as a child, the one I experienced as a young officer, and the one I left in 2010 were as different as the times they resided in. The history I experienced was the backdrop to my life and largely defined, enabled, all limited, all I did or did not do. Leadership was always the objective. From my earliest memories, leadership was an overt, ever-present theme. The books my mother gave me to read as a boy, the stories of Roland, William Tell, and Robert Bruce, were about leaders' courage and service. In Stonewall Jackson's elementary school's library, I found youth-oriented biographies of John Paul Jones and Davy Crockett that I read surreptitiously in Mrs. Lynch's second-grade classroom. In later life, it was no less important. I came to judge myself and others more on their ability to lead than any other quality. The core of the story is my life, from my birth in 1954 to Captain and Mrs. Herbert Joseph McChrystal, Jr. at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to the present. Like all lives, mine has been a personal journey, enriched by experiences and people that have matured into memories and relationships of unexpected importance to me. If my appreciation for the constellation of family and friendships through I've known comes through, I've succeeded. More than I ever anticipated in the early years of my career, my story intersected with events of historical significance and in later years with policy issues. I attempt to describe what I saw and evaluate its meaning, but I leave current policy prescription to others. Though this is my memoir, I treated my own recollection of events as only the starting point, as I attempted to compile an accurate view of what happened. Doing so required the generous help of comrades and participants. Throughout the course of the writing, more than 50 people were interviewed, most of them more than once. Many more reviewed drafts and episodes in order to verify the accuracy and fairness of descriptions. I am particularly grateful to the Afghans who participated, giving insights on their lives and their country that only their country can provide. To meet my legal and moral commitments to the Department of Defense, my country, and my former comrades, I work closely with United States SOCOM, Special Operations Command, during the 22-month writing process, and upon completion, submitted the entire manuscript to the Department of Defense for a lengthy security review. In the end, I accepted many suggested changes and redactions, some reluctantly, particularly where public knowledge of facts and events had outspaced as existing security guidelines, while laboring to maintain the coherence of the story. But despite imperfections in the process, I judge compliance with the security review to be essential for me to keep my faith with the comrades I had served alongside and the nation I had served. My goal was to ensure that the following chapters do not endanger our mission or our stalwart personnel in any way. I believe I have accomplished that goal. Those who generously participated with me in the research and writing process were assured the book would undergo a security review, and the professionals who provided their insights and perspectives on this unique time in history would not have done so otherwise. At various points in the book, for their protection, some individuals' names have been shortened to initials or replaced with pseudonyms. Finally, I have no doubt the book reflects the flaws of my memory and biases I've developed many unconsciously over a lifetime. I ask the reader's forbearance for these shortcomings. Humble guy. And then begins my share of the task. And the intro is a quotation from Voltaire. God is not on the side of big battalions, but on the side of those who shoot best. Okay. And then begins the Ghosts of Christmas Past. I don't want to start it. It's quite long, but and I've probably bored you enough. But I chose McChrystal as my candidate for presidency because no one is paying attention to him. So that means one side can't use him, and the other side does no longer considers him a threat. But I think he would make a great president. And if World War III begins on his watch, you're going to wish you had a guy like McChrystal. You don't want community activist man to tell you why we're going to have to surrender. It will save lives. Yeah. And his biggest regret tonight is that he doesn't have everybody's guns under lock and key. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll check some blogs. And my candidate for presidency, hardly knowing anything about him except that he was a commander in Afghanistan. And he was a hands-on commander, not like this mush they got in Washington now, Dumpster Dempsey. This guy never leaves Washington. Patton would have shot him right off the bat. Patton would have replaced him with a sergeant. Yeah, we're in trouble, guys. We're really in trouble. You have no idea how much trouble we're in. You got kids in college that owe $160,000. They don't have a job. And you know why? Because they're doing the marijuana.
Permit me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kick. I dwell in a dark dominion away down by the river Styx. The devil has sent me here because I'm full of wicked tricks. And I'm such a popular fellow among all you lunatics. A course in ruination from the devil's text. To fools who can't withstand temptation, step right up, you're next. I hail from a hollow hellhole down along the river Styx. Allow me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kicks. When an old wolf starts prowling out among the young lambs howling, don't you know he's looking for kicks? When a young cat full of fly tricks spends his evenings chasing fly chicks, 10 to 1 he's looking for kicks.
Kicks is always in demand, cause Kicks is full of fun and laughter. Lots of folks get out of hand because it's only Kicks they're after. Shady lady and her lover operating undercover. She knows sin and virtue don't mix. Her mama raised her prim and proper, but now while her pills couldn't stop her when she's on a manhunt for Kicks. Kicks, yeah, yeah, looking for kicks, just kicks, nothing but kicks. I'm Satan's sinful servant sent to get you in a fix, so look me up just anytime. The name is Mr., name is Mr., name is Mr. Kicks.
Okay. The big news tonight is Eric Holder had a big conference today, and he told everybody, you don't have to enforce laws you disagree with. So I walked into my bank, and I said, you know, bank robbery is a felony. But Eric Holder says that I don't have to enforce that law if I don't agree with it. So stick them up, everybody. Yeah, too much, man. We're in trouble. We're really in trouble. Wait till he starts to tell you that sin is not a sin. Yeah, they'll probably pass legislation. Attorney General Eric Holder, the murderer of 100,000 helpless Mexicans, sending 22,000 guns into Mexico to arm the Sinaloa cartel. Yes, who is now was in prison, the head, El Chapo, because he chops up all his victims. El Chapo, he was sentenced to prison. He was caught once. He was sentenced to prison, and he escaped in a laundry basket. And as the laundry truck was going out, everybody, including the guards, was waving goodbye. Yeah, he went out with the laundry. Oh, man. Speaking of laundries, the Democrat Party's got a big laundry, don't they? What do they call it? What's that new term for stolen money? Champagne contributions. Do you know that if the champagne contribution, by law, could only be $1, be you Joe DePlumba or General Electric of China, do you know that we would all be equal as Americans? Instead of that make-believe equal that the communists tell you you are, or not, depending on which side of the revolution. You know, the communists always back both sides of the revolution. You know that, right? Jimmy from Brooklyn says, when they win, they win, and when they lose, they win. So, Eric Holder, in an interview with the New York Communist Times, who endorsed Joseph Stalin, Holder said state attorneys general do not have to enforce laws they disagree with. Murder? Yeah, specifically when it comes to the issue of gay marriage. Oh, here comes the groom. Here comes the other groom. Yeah, oh my goodness. It is highly unusual for the United States Attorney General to increase hatred among the people. Yeah, to foster a revolution and to divide the nation. I'm improvising what the New York Times said. So disregard this as being totally from the New York Times because I'm El Chapo editorially. Yeah. So he said to his state counterparts on how and when to refuse to defend state laws. Yeah, and would you please keep those borders open? Because there's a lot of people got to come through yet. But Mr. Holder said when laws touch on core constitutional issues like equal protection, an attorney general should apply the highest level of scrutiny before reaching a decision on whether to defend it. He also said if everybody behaves, they can all be buried in the Kremlin wall when they pass away. He said the decision would never be political or based on political objections. Engaging in what process in making that determination is something that's appropriate for an attorney general to do. Yes, to be continued during the revolution. Yeah, so what he basically said is communism will win over the evil empire of the United States, comrades. So here's a few comments. Coffee 49 says, and I don't follow laws I don't agree with, including the SAFE Act. Viva Revolution. And this guy, Looney Toonesville, says, I, Eric Holder, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Yeah. And unless Obama declares martial law and we go communist. Does this mean I don't believe in the 25-mile-an-hour law, I can now do 65? The American people ought to be proud of what they put in Congress, White House, and SCOTUS's Supreme Court of the U.S. Our system of government has broken down. Congress is full of us because we put them there. The president is in an office because we put him there. The people have no one to blame but themselves. It's true. They're all busy smoking the marijuana. They're getting high, but not in pay. The government is the essence of the people. The Democratic Party does and denies, and the people vote them into office. I think the Arab word for lying to reach an objective is called takfir. I think that's what it is. I might be wrong. But that's what the Democrat Party practices, lying to accomplish the goal. When that guy, Joe, what was his name, Wilson, shouted liar, and everybody went, oh, blasphemy, blasphemy. He was so right. I was hoping he would have done it again. I would have loved to have seen him done it again. The people are more interested in what they can get out of government money, forgetting that they are the ones who fed the government. Taxation is pervasive. You may think you don't pay taxes, but you do. Yeah, somebody sent me a notice that said, you know, the poor people don't pay taxes. No? When you mean when they buy that can of beer, they don't, there's no tax? Huh? They got to run around and bring the can back for a nickel? Huh? And if they don't bring it back, they lose a nickel? And who makes that nickel? That blood-sucking government. My comment was moderated for some reason. Basically, I asked that with all the voter fraud, why do we think we put them there? God help us. I see the government is nothing but a cesspool. Holder is unfit for office, just like his lawless boss. Yeah, it's the American way. Guy's got to, don't tread on me, so he's got to be Tea Party. This is a lawless regime that Obama has put together, and they're getting away with it. It's hard to imagine the United States Attorney General says you don't have to enforce laws you disagree with. It's actually breathtaking. If I were an elected politician, I would subpoena. And you know what? You want to know the story about subpoenas? They don't work. Nobody comes. And then you got guys up there like the real tough enforcer who was on the Bill Maher show laughing it up with the Bill PLO Dancer Maher, who immediately washed out any faith I had in him. And that was, what's his name? Daryl Issa. Or Daryl Issa. Yeah, right down the tubes he went. One flush, he was gone. Yep. He says he's going to subpoena, and then they don't come. They don't even respond to my love letters. Yeah, thanks a lot, Daryl. We'll see you on the campus. Yeah. I would have removed from the position of Attorney General. I don't know the procedures well enough to know. That's our problem. We don't know the procedures. We're all going to be running around looking for copies of the First Amendment when the Gestapo shows up at the house. Gosh, Eric Holder is sounding more like his boss, the dictatorial president, every day. A nation of fools is elected, a party of fools. oh, this guy, he says Holder is, he says a bad word. Let's see. So he would encourage AGs to not enforce the Defense of Marriage Act and other laws his gang don't like. But when AGs decide that there are laws passed prior to 2011 that they disagree with and effectively nullify the progressives' laws, maybe I should claim to disagree with man-made laws, ignore them, and nullify them in my own life. See, we're all, you know what I, you know what gets me when people get really enraged with the law that's been passed, and they'll say, you know what, we'd be better off with the Sharia law to cut his head off. Yeah, that's it, man. They're waiting. Come, let the Muslims come and cut everybody's head off. Yeah, this guy says Huck Folder, then jail him. You can bet your ass Hillary will go along with this, and if she gets elected, she took lessons from O.J. and gets away with murder. O.J., poor O.J., huh? Poor innocent O.J. He's still out there looking for those. Oh no, he's not out there. He's in jail, right? He got away with murder, but he got 25 years for selling baseball cards. Oh man, do we have a sense of justice here in this country? It was right. You know that they took his driver's license away when he made his escape, so he had to put his white Ford Bronco on a tow truck, and he was in the Ford Bronco on the tow truck, and everybody was cheering him on. Yeah, man, I tell you, we're sick, sick nation. Absolutely sick. Oh, and there's some racial slurs here I can't say. White honky. I can't repeat those. It's not bringing us together. Yeah, you know what brings us together? A nuclear attack. Yeah, that's what it'll take to bring us together. And then we'll be calling each other brother as we go to the gallows. Yeah, oh, they can't have gallows in this country. I'm an American citizen. I have rights. Oh, we heard that story before. You know what you need? You need a little Morse code. How about, do you want to do a little My Country, 'Tis of Thee? And do it to those poor bastards out in the Hindu Kush, huh? That are freezing their asses off tonight, getting a 1% pay cut, getting a letter from their wife saying she had to put the 2 cans of dog food back on the commissary shelf, and the commissary shelf may not be there next year because Obama is going to starve out the military. This guy's a siege chief.
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I see. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. Let music swell the breeze, and ring from all the trees, sweet freedom song. Let mortal tongues awake, let all that grieve partake, let rocks their silence break, the sound prolong. Protect us by
liked about McChrystal, like I told you, I don't know this guy at all, okay? I just think he got a raw deal. I think he was set up. And, of course, the guy that broke the news is dead, and he died mysteriously when his car sped up while he had his foot on the brake and hit a tree and the car exploded. Yes, that lends credibility to a possible investigation that may be being covered up right now. And they did investigate McChrystal, and he had nothing to do with it. Yeah, see how quick they would reach out there for a scapegoat, a little diversion, like a guy that made a video that five Muslims seen and liked, and they blamed him for Benghazi. Yeah, what a joke. Here's chapter one. Ghosts of Christmas Past, December 2009. Christmas is not an external event at all, but a piece of one's home that one carries in one's heart. That's a quotation by Freya Stark, which leads off the chapter. This is a very short chapter, so. The interior of the UH-60 Black Hawk was dark to avoid presenting a glowing target in the night sky. Gunners on either side of the helicopter manned machine guns, maintaining a constant vigil for enemy threats. Before the rugged Afghan landscape, devoid of any speck of man-made light, was even darker. I could just make out hills, valleys, and an occasional mud-brown compound. Inside the aircraft, it was cold, and I pulled my parka tightly around me. The Army issue gear was far better than it had been in the earlier years of my career. But lately, I seemed to feel cold more than I had back then. It was 2009, and at 55, I wasn't the young lieutenant I had been 34 years earlier. At best, I was a well-worn version of the officer who had spent so many nights like this one alongside warriors. You see, this is a hands-on guy. One of the things that drew me to McChrystal was a photo of McChrystal coming out of a meeting, and a private was saluting him. And rather than return the salute, he reached out and shook his hand. How's that? You don't see too many generals doing that. In a few hours, it would be Christmas. Although I didn't know it at the time, it would be my last as a soldier. I looked around at the other men on the aircraft. Although we all wore headsets connected through the UH-60's intercom system, we rarely spoke. Normally, during long night flights, men were lost in thought, and especially tonight. I respected their solitude. The 8 years of war since 9/11 had meant several Christmases away from home for most of these men. For soldiers at war, their comforting continuity in the traditions and inevitability of Christmas, we savored memories of Christmas past. The inevitability of Christmas, we savored memories of Christmas past. Made the most of it or endured the ones we had at the time. I dreamed incessantly about those we'd have in the future. I felt a bit like Dickens, Scrooge, and pushing them so hard on a night that should be special. For each of us, Christmas stirred deep memories and strong emotions, but this was the life of our choice. Sitting directly across from me was my aide, Major Casey Welch, no doubt thinking about his wife and two small children. Casey had spent 27 months in combat in Iraq, including a year, a tough year in Samarra. He had been home for only 5 months when I had been designated to command in Afghanistan, and he volunteered to deploy again. Sitting next to Casey was an unimposing figure hunched over a dimly lit laptop. The reading glasses and lines on his face matched mine. I couldn't help but smile slightly as I watched him work. Mike Hall was my old friend and, most important, the finest soldier I ever knew. After over 30 years of service and then 18 months at a good civilian job, a phone call had brought the retired command sergeant major back on active duty to become the senior enlisted advisor of all international forces in Afghanistan. Now he would spend yet another Christmas away from his wife, Brenda, and son, Jeff. Charlie sat to my left, close by, as always. I had known Colonel Charlie Flynn since he was a lieutenant 23 years earlier, and I remembered how his first child, Molly, had been born while Charlie was deployed in the first Gulf War. A couple of years later, he commanded a company for me in the 2nd Ranger Battalion, and his young son, Sean, was climbing over pews at Christmas Eve in the historic Fort Lewis Chapel. 13 years later, upon his redeployment in 2008 from his 4th combat tour, 15 months commanding a brigade combat team in Iraq, I asked him to join me in the Pentagon as my executive assistant. When alerted for Afghanistan in May of 2009, the first two officers I sought to form the nucleus of the team were Charlie and his older brother Mike. Just behind the Byrds pilots sat Chief Warrant Officer Sean Lowry, the man responsible for our security. With a shaved head and a serious countenance, Sean's all-business gravitas masked a dry, wicked sense of humor. He pronounced himself unenthusiastic about my decision not to wear body armor some months prior, but took the decision in stride. Sean had been back from the most recent tour of Afghanistan less than a year when I was notified to deploy, but he had volunteered without hesitation to go forward again. As the December air rushed into the open windows where the door guns were mounted, I readied myself for the next stop, continuing a tradition of military commanders. Starting that afternoon, we began a journey to visit 6 outposts on Christmas Eve. The next would be the 5th. At each location, we spent time with soldiers, gave them a short talk, normally in their mess hall, and took the opportunity to circulate posts for pictures that they could send home, and most important, thank them. It was tiring but unfailingly inspiring to me. A few hours later, on Christmas Day, we would launch again to six other bases, several manned by soldiers from our coalition partners, Christmases with Polish and Romanian troops, including religious ceremonies and crude bunkers and huts, were deeply spiritual experiences. Soothed by the rhythmic vibrations of the rotors, my mind wandered to the more than half a century of Christmases I'd experienced. I remembered early morning excitement as my 4 brothers, 1 sister, and I rushed down to the living room of our small Arlington, Virginia house, where presents from Santa Claus were reliably piled up for each of us. I most loved getting toy soldiers I could use with the handcrafted wooden forts my father built and my mother painted. During the years my father was in Vietnam, my mother struggled to make Christmases special. I could only guess how my father felt until I got a taste as a young captain in Korea during my first year-long separation from my wife Annie along the DMZ on Christmas Eve. A well-intentioned morale visit to our unit by the USO tour only made me miss Annie and Christmas all the more. Becoming a father made Christmas more important to me than ever. Fatherhood was a great excuse to play with toys again. I remember the fun Annie and I had staying up late assembling a plastic fort for my son Sam's Rambo figurines. And I could still hear my father shaming me into finally buying Annie a color TV. Even memories of pungy steak-like pain from stepping barefoot on a rogue Lego block now brought a smile. So he must have taken a pungy stick, huh? I wanted the young men and women I'd visit that night to know that I understood the ache inherent in Christmas so far from home. I had spent four straight Christmases starting in 2004 in Iraq or Afghanistan, typically traveling to be in one location on Christmas Eve, then making a night flight to be in the other on Christmas Day. I'd listened to Christmas music on my iPad, particularly Alabama's Christmas in Dixie, which made me homesick. But I couldn't help it, and I knew that as much as I missed Annie and Sam, young soldiers bore the heavier burden of missing the all-too-temporary magic of their children's holiday joy. As we reached the forward operating base, or FOB, we could see from the air the series of simple buildings constructed of Afghan bricks and mortar. It was a small fortified post manned by a combined U.S. and Afghan force totaling about 75 soldiers. Its position on high ground above Afghanistan's open terrain gave it a deceptively imposing Beaugest-like appearance. I just used that Beaugest in a description of something else. I forget what it was. In a few minutes, I'd be able to see that for myself. We landed a couple of hundred meters away and walked with the commanding officer through the gate and into the outpost. Because it was dark and cold, we met the soldiers inside. Like most small outposts, this one was rudimentary but functional. Generators provided power. There was a small operations and communication center, bay, barracks, in which groups of soldiers arranged bunks and gear and a mess hall. Small trees and other decorations obviously sent by loved ones brought a Christmas into the crude surroundings. Except for some of the more modern equipment, soldiers on similar counterinsurgency duty in the American West in 1868, the Philippines in 1900, Malaya in 1950, Indochina in 1952, Algeria in 1956, or Vietnam in 1965, might have found the outpost familiar. It was warfare at its most basic, where success depended more on lieutenant sergeants and privates in lonely forts or on small patrols than on grand plans in a general's headquarter. George Patton said, no decent combat decision was ever made in a swivel chair. As always, As always, the officers and senior and non-commissioned officers were polite and forthcoming. But the younger troops were initially distant and uncommunicative, as though they were only there because they had been directed to show up. Their reticence didn't bother me. It was always that way. Only afterward, when Mike Hall and I spoke to them as a group, presented some hard-earned awards, and then mingled, offering to pose for pictures and answer questions, did they loosen up. Before long, the gathering became animated, and I felt connected to them. As we prepared to reboard the UH-60 to fly to our final stop for the night, several groups were asked to take pictures with Mike and me. While we assembled one group, I introduced myself to a young soldier, as I always tried to do. I began by looking at the rank and the name tape on his combat uniform so I could address him personally as possible. I read his name and paused, and then I asked him quietly if his father had been a soldier. He said that he had. I cautiously asked if his father had been a ranger. The young man, anticipating what I was trying to determine, confirmed that his father had been a ranger who I had known well. After leaving the Rangers, his father had joined an elite Army commando unit and was killed in 2005 in a nighttime raid on an Al-Qaeda safe house. He had been lost under my command during the summer of bitter fighting in Iraq's western Euphrates River Valley at a critical juncture in the war that now felt a lifetime past. Now his young son had taken his place in the ranks. For a moment I was silenced. There was no outward drama or emotion. The young man clearly sought no special recognition. It felt strangely natural. I asked about his mother and soon moved on to talk to other young soldiers. But as I did, it struck me that in an era when military service is a question of choice, he, like his father, had chosen to spend Christmas in rough surroundings. I looked around the room at the young soldiers and their slightly older sergeants. They had all made the same choice. On the flight north that night, I absorbed the continuity of war. I knew from history that war comes with frightening regularity, often fought over the same ground and similar causes as previous conflicts. War also often began with enthusiastic vigor, but typically settled into costly, dirty business characterized by soldiers, for soldiers, by fear, frustration, and loneliness. There was also a continuity in soldiers, in the young soldiers on outposts and their sergeants and the junior officers who led them, and particularly in the team of professionals I worked alongside each day. The Charlies, the Mikes, the Caseys, the Shawns, I felt the unbroken tradition of commitment to a mission and a fierce commitment to one another, like the generations they followed and those they now led. They came forward when called and sacrificed when needed. They did so quietly, often in the shadows, with no expectation of a reward. They were no better than their grandfathers and not a bit worse. And there was Christmas. So, you got chapter one out of General McChrystal. That's why I've endorsed him for president. And I'll probably be the only one, but you never can tell. I once started a rumor when I was in the service that we were going to ship out from Fort Hood, Texas, to the Gulf of Mexico. We're going to do a forced march, and then we're going to leave by submarine to Formosa. And a week later, I saw the battalion commander and the PX buying water wings. So you never can tell, you know? It's, what is it, one little spark, it kindles a big fire? You never can tell. Okay. So, we'll give you an exit tune. We'll play this for all the troops. And we'll play it for all who serve. And God bless America.